This is Phil Farron, and I am walking around. So it is Christmas week, and I had fully intended, excuse me a minute, I'm still a little clogged up. It's been like 3 weeks of this stuff. Goodness, 3 weeks. But I do feel like I'm coming out of it now. So I fully intended to do this on Christmas. Then I had Aiden, and Nett was bustling around in the kitchen trying to get some things done, and it just completely drifted away from me. So I didn't even realize I hadn't done the podcast until one of my faithful listeners, one of my handful of faithful listeners, actually wrote me this morning and said, "Were you going to do a podcast?" I was like, "Right. Need to do that." So it is an absolutely gorgeous day out today. So I'm just going to go for a little walk and get some sun and talk about what I was going to talk about. And honestly, this topic's probably better not to do on Christmas. So this is going to get a little earthy today. So fair warning. I do believe that God is a good designer, and I believe he has a purpose in all things he does, and I believe that there is nothing to be embarrassed about in the way he has designed the human body and in the wondrous functioning that it accomplishes. So having said all those things, we'll get into it in a little bit, because I do find this fascinating. And the implications are fascinating for what it might mean in terms of relationships between men and women. So it's a pretty interesting thing. And the host of Sean Ryan, I think it was Sean Ryan. I think so. It was the Sean Ryan Show podcast that the topic came up on. So anyways, aside from the other stuff, I am still kind of piddling along. I really haven't started the second writing sprint yet for the final book in the Windfall series. I've piddled at it a little bit, writing a few things here and there, but I have allowed other stuff, other projects to intervene. I'm obviously still working on the Mario Brothers stuff. And now there's another little project. I'll talk about that in a second. But I don't technically have to start the second writing sprint until January 1st. So I'm taking advantage of this. I cleaned out the garage of boxes earlier this week and, you know, finished printing up a bunch of stuff, finished gluing a bunch of stuff, just took that time and poured it into other projects that needed to kind of get up to a certain level so that when I hit the writing sprint, I'm ready to go. So it's been a good week. It's been a very relaxing week. Got a lot of good stuff done. Dustin is ramping up to take his test for the national certification. He's been taking some practice tests, and the practice tests appear to not be calibrated very well with the final test. He was telling me that most of the other people in his class had already taken the test and they had already passed the finals test of the national test. And so they've been telling him, you just need to rip the band-aid off. And I've been telling that too, you know, just go in, take it, see what happens. So I think he's going to try to get that done next week. And I fully expect him to pass. But even if he doesn't, I've told him, you know, even if you go and you bomb, it's fine. You know, you get past that initial, all the uncertainties about what it's going to be like to take this. You have a little experience then, and then from that experience you go in, you know what to expect. The next time you're more relaxed. He's got all the stuff. He knows it. You know, it's just a matter of going and doing the thing. So hopefully that'll get done this next week, and I'll have a good report for you that he has passed his national final next week. So anyways, if you think of him, you might say a word of prayer for him. This is the culmination of a year-long journey, and he's done well all through his classes and his classwork and his class finals and all that kind of stuff. This is just that last piece. So writing is good. Know where I'm going with that, but haven't really kicked off. Costumes are good. I think I decided just within the last day or two that I would try to do a costume for next weekend. This weekend is Happy New Year from Baby Spring. I do this every year where I have a sunflower costume with the tutu and the whole bit. You know, people love it. And I tell them Happy New Year from Baby Spring, and I explain that, you know, spring is already here. It's just a baby. And what we have to do is just give it a chance to grow up. It's going to be 2 or 3 months, and then everything will be beautiful again. Well, the problem this year is that it is like 75 degrees for this Christmas. And I mean, I've got shorts and a tank top on, trying to get some sun here. And it's beautiful out. I mean, this feels like a late spring day. So it's really going to confuse the trees if this keeps up. But unfortunately, we are scheduled, I think Sunday, that the weather's going to turn cold. Big, big drop. I mean, it's, from what I understand, it's going to be a tens of degrees drop on Sunday. All down. Yay, that's the Ozarks for you. But anyways, so something to look forward to. So I did decide to try to take a run at a costume for next weekend, because the first, like Christmas, fell on a Thursday this year. And that's a little awkward when you're trying to celebrate that holiday, because you're doing it on the Friday before. And it's just a little weird to be that far away from the holiday celebrating it. So I started looking around thinking, well, I wonder what other holidays there might be around this time that I might be able to do. And I looked it up. Turns out January the 2nd is National Science Fiction Day. So I was like, well, there's probably a lot of stuff I could do for that. So I looked around, and finally I kind of settled on, because there's so many things that you could do for National Science Fiction Day. And I kind of settled back to the old retro 1950s type sci-fi movies. And I thought it would be fun to do something in that vein. So I found myself a silver LeMay bodysuit, and I have boots. I already got boots for like a Love Your Robot Day costume. They are actually bigger boots, or higher boots, chunkier, I should say, boots than I used for the actual Love Your Robot Day costume. But, you know, I thought, well, maybe I'll dig those out, use those. And then it took me a while, but I realized that my whole costume making stuff is very much different now, because I have a 3D printer. So normally what I would do in this case is I would dig around on Amazon, and I would do my best to find something on Amazon, you know, the pieces. Once you get into that retro sci-fi stuff, there's not a ton of stuff. I found a little toy blaster that I thought, oh, I can make that work. And you know, so I ordered a bunch of stuff 2 days ago, a day ago, 3 days ago, sometime, I don't know. Wednesday night, I think it was. So a couple of days ago, I ordered a bunch of stuff. And that's the good thing about Amazon, because you can just send it back. So, and then like last night, I started thinking, wait a minute, I have a 3D printer and I'm doing well on getting the parts printed for Mario. So I could just camp onto that for a couple of days and print some things. So I started looking around for models, and sure enough, there's a blaster from Fallout 2 that I'm gonna make, and I'm gonna make like a Star Trek communicator, and then like a Star Trek tricorder. Except I'm gonna make the one from Next Gen, not the one from Classic. So, I mean, it's gonna be a whole mishmash of things. I'm still looking for a helmet, but I did order a pair of dog fence half spheres, you know, those things that you cut a hole in the fence and you put this globe, half globe in it, and you bolt it to the fence so the dog can look out. Well, if you take two of those and bolt them together, you can get yourself a big spherical clear plastic helmet. So I'm gonna do that, but I still need the helmet to wear inside the helmet. So, you know, it's just a little, we're just piddling. But it should be fun. It'll just be a quick throwaway, and I think people will probably enjoy it. Next year, I think we're actually going to be back to a schedule that was very, very similar to when I started out during the doing the costumes consistently, because that was 2020. So with 2026 and with the leap year involved, I think we're going to be kind of back into the old pattern I started with. So we'll see. So all is well. All is going on. It's all fine. So today, I was listening to Sean Ryan, this podcast, and he was interviewing a former Soviet spy, a female spy, and it was a former Soviet female spy who was involved in honeypot operations. And it was very interesting. And she now goes around and talks to business executives and talks to governmental officials and things like that, you know, explaining the signs to look for and, you know, kind of the warning things. And it was interesting because she said, oh yeah, she said, you go out to Silicon Valley and there's just, you know, Ukrainian girls and Russian girls and Chinese girls everywhere. And Sean Ryan was asking, you know, how many of those are probably spies? And she was like, I can't remember if she said most of them or whatever, or there's a high probability, because, you know, this just works. It just works. And she was talking about being out at one IT conference where she spoke, and, you know, she was sharing with them the techniques that young women will use to attract their attention, and then what comes next, and, you know, when they'll ask the questions and all those things. And all of that was interesting. She said that one tech executive came up and talked to her, and he said, you know, at the end of the day, I don't really care. Said, because I get to sleep with pretty women. So, okay, so there you go, you know. He doesn't care. He's happy to get his chance to, you know, surrender to the drives of his reproductive system. And it's not really, see, we'll get back to that in a second. You know, to surrender to the drives of his systems, we'll say that. And, you know, he'll try to be careful to not leak any information, but things happen. However, there was one point in there when Sean Ryan started talking to her on more personal levels about doing these types of operations. And that's when it started getting really interesting. Because in my little world, and in my attempt to make sense of the world, an attempt to make sense of our existence, an attempt to try to figure out how things work, I have developed certain models of the world and models for interactions of males and females. And I had already, I've probably mentioned them in times past, but just to kind of go over the basics in this one particular area, when you look at the design of the reproductive systems, by that I mean those systems which contribute in some way, biologically, directly, physically, into the process of creating a child, there's a really interesting distribution. And when you kind of analyze the demands that are made on men versus women in these systems, there's a huge amount of inequity. I mean, you know, the guy can get his part done literally in seconds sometimes, and the female spends 9 months carrying this child and then, you know, has primary responsibility for keeping that child alive, you know, for months afterwards. And there is definitely a unique bond between mother and child. Not to say that men don't love their children, because good men do love their children. But it's just different between a mother and her children and her child. It's just flat out different. And I know we speak a great deal of the wonders of a mother's love. But there is, I think, a more honest approach to that. And that is that the investment that men make in children, the direct physical investment that men make in children, is minor compared to the physical investment that women make in children. And rightly so, women, I think, have an expectation to have some benefit for that investment that they're making. One of the ways I've talked about this is women play the long game when it comes to having children. They know that it's dangerous. They know that it's going to take a lot of work. But if all goes well, those children then will be available to care for her about the time that her husband's ability to care for her begins to fade. And so it is perfectly reasonable for a woman to expect that her investment in those children is going to create a situation where she will gain dividends on that investment later, decades later. So, and honestly, I think there is a component in the rejoicing over grandchildren that seems to be much stronger in women than in men. Not to say that grandfathers don't love their children, but grandmothers, whoo, you know, they love their grandchildren. And again, I don't think it's untoward to point out that in fact that is another payout on the investment that a woman makes in bearing a child. She expects that the investment in that child is going to cascade into grandchildren, and that those grandchildren will be a resource that she can call upon if necessary. I don't think there's anything wrong with imaging a mother's love in those terms. It's just simply what is. Now then, if you look at it that way, then you can also start making sense of the profound differences between the way men and women relate to the world. So one of the oldest ways that I tried to make it make sense in my own brain for the differences at a fundamental level, and we call this, you know, a low resolution, because it's on average, in general, it's not saying that every woman is this way or every man is this way. It's saying that on average, in general, men tend to be more governed from their reproductive systems by lust, and women tend to be more governed by their reproductive systems by fear. And this actually shows up in the big five personality traits that Jordan Peterson often talks about. You know, those big five personality traits are, they spell ocean. They are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, aggression, and neuroticism. So the first three are positive traits. The last two are negative traits. And when you deal with the first three, which are positive, from what I understand, on average, in general, it's kind of a wash between men and women. It all kind of balances out. I'm going to find a little bench here and sit down. It balances out, and you know, you find a fairly even distribution, for instance, in openness between men and women. You find a fairly even distribution in conscientiousness between men and women. Some women are more conscientious, some are less. Some men are more conscientious, some are less. But it runs on a bell curve. Same thing with extroversion versus introversion. Runs on a bell curve. You know, you see a distribution between men and women that's pretty even. You don't see that with aggression. Now, there's not a huge amount of skew, but it's definitely there. So, according to Jordan Peterson, which this seems reasonable to me, if you had 50 men and 50 women in a room and you randomly chose any one man or any one woman, and you tried to guess whether they were more or less aggressive than the norm, if you guessed they were more aggressive for the man, you would be right about 60% of the time. And if you guessed that women were more aggressive, you would only be right about 40% of the time. Because over all the averages, men tend to be more aggressive than women. And the distribution is about 60-40, not 50-50. Same thing holds true for neuroticism. Neuroticism is fear, anxiety, you know, mental illnesses, all those kinds of things. With neuroticism, however, it's flipped. And so what you see with neuroticism is a shift towards a 60-40 split in favor of women. That you tend to see more neurotic behaviors in women. Well, I chalk up the aggression in men to testosterone. That's without testosterone, I don't think men would consistently score more aggressive. I think you can show changes in men when their testosterone goes down, and those changes can be directly affected by giving them more testosterone. And many of those changes are directly indicated in aggressive behavior. With women, I personally believe that it is all of the hormones that are necessary to make the whole reproductive cycle work with women, that estrogen tends to make women, well, it's either estrogen or progesterone. One of those guys in there, in that whole way, mix, tends to make women more anxiety-ridden. And women actually live under a load, a heavier load, of fear-inducing, anxiety-inducing mindsets. And it's not all in their minds. It's actually a result of their hormones. And in fact, men who decide they want to have a closer appearance to women and start taking hormone replacement therapy, they actually do report more fearful thoughts, more anxiety, all those types of things, because those are embedded in that. Now, what's really interesting is as women cycle through the month, the mix of chemicals changes. And as they are approaching their fertility, their 2 or 3 days when they are fertile, if they're still fertile, their testosterone will actually rise. And that makes them more aggressive, more risk-taking, and more acceptable to chance encounters and all those types of things, because you've got to get the sexes together and get some breeding going on if you're going if you're going to populate the earth. That's just the way the system's built. Conversely, after those times when the woman is fertile, her body will then just go into a protect mode just in case she has been impregnated, that it doesn't want to do anything that will cut down on the chances that that egg is going to embed itself and start to grow, et cetera, et cetera. So women tend then to become more conservative after the days that they spent when they could get pregnant. There are sociologists that have done studies on this stuff. It's all extremely fascinating. Anyways, said all that to say, when you have a situation where you have this extreme emotional load that is placed on women, but it's not placed on men, I could very easily see how women would consider that unfair. And I could very easily see how, even though life is a miracle and it's amazing and all of that stuff, at the same time, it does put, the creation of human life does put a heavier load on women. Okay. So then the question becomes, okay, if that's true and God's a good designer, did he just have it out for women? Or was there absolutely no other option? Or did he provide something else? And I have maintained for years that, yes, he did provide something else, because as we finally started learning only decades ago, the female pleasure system is unlike the male pleasure system. The male pleasure system is directly related to activities that can lead to reproduction. Obviously, we're talking about ejaculation. However, men, I don't think, really have a reproductive drive. They have an ejaculation drive, because men will stick it anywhere. And there's a whole host of things that wouldn't even exist if men were strictly concerned about reproduction. And I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Okay, so with the male reproductive system that is really just tuned towards ejaculation, the pleasure is all tied up in that system. It's tied up in the ejaculation. Men get a reward for that, so men want to do that more. However, it is quite possible for a woman to become pregnant without ever having an orgasm. And that's because those two systems are not directly tied together. They are actually separate systems. They happen to be located in the same place. And up until the 1990s, no one ever bothered to go and do much exploration on the female pleasure system. And it turns out it is a substantial system. It's not tiny, it's quite large, and it has quite a number of nerve endings in it, and it's quite sophisticated. And it is not directly tied to reproduction. Now, what do we make of that? Well, what I make of that is that God knew that in order to drive the population of the planet forward, you had to have this deep, visceral, elemental drive in women to have children. And that deep, elemental drive is not served well by just making it pleasurable. It's not enough. You have to make it anxiety-driven, because that will get you a lot farther than pleasure will. And it will get you a lot farther in all circumstances. Aside from plenty. But that's a whole other discussion. We've had that discussion. So even in the midst of turmoil and wars and famine and all of those types of things, women will continue to have children, because having children relieves them from a level of anxiety, and they find great comfort in simply caring for a child. So then what's the role of that pleasure system in there? Because it is a very effective pleasure system, and it's very sophisticated. It's been my belief for years and years and years that that pleasure system in women exists as the counterbalance to the anxiety that is coupled with the reproductive process. That's God's gift to women, recognizing that there's overhead in being this magical being that can grow a human being. And that pleasure system is God's reward for that. Now then, this has probably gone very long. It's 34 minutes. We are very long. So let me just very quickly, I'm going to kind of put this down a little bit here and just grab my notes. Let me just very quickly go through what she talked about, because we don't necessarily hear about women using their pleasure systems in this way. But I think what it proves, what it shows, is the pleasure system that a woman possesses is, maybe a word is fungible, it is transferable, it is manipulatable, it's convertible into many different things and many different techniques. And in fact, it is powerful enough to assist with the anxiety that women live with. So one of the things that came up, because as Sean Ryan was kind of digging in and saying, okay, but you know, you're sleeping with these men because you're a honeypot and honey trap, and you know, how do you, like, what happens emotionally, and what happens, how do you act like you're enjoying being with them, even though they're just a target and stuff? And she just stopped him at one point, and she said, oh, she said, every man I slept with, every man that I targeted, everyone, I had orgasms with all of them when we had sex, every time. And he looked at her and he went, what? And she said, yes. She said, this is what they taught us. She said, I always had orgasms when I had sex with them. Now, of course, okay, in the first place, if that's true, then the men she was sleeping with, she could use that to manipulate him as well, because, oh, you're just so good at this. And, you know, I mean, he's going to know if he has any awareness about him. And what she explained is that they were taught techniques. So she started going through the techniques, and she was saying that these same techniques that she used to train herself with this, she said those same techniques are used to manage anxiety and fear and lack of confidence. And this is the place where I was like, right, right, there it is. She says, so I would stand in front of a mirror, and she said, I teach young women who attend my courses on confidence. She said, take off all your clothes, you stand in front of a mirror naked. She said, we as women, we always, you know, are looking at our bodies and finding faults. But she said, you examine your body, you grow used to looking at your body. She said, and then you begin to manipulate yourself, whether she said you're using your... Now, okay, this is where it gets plain, okay. If it hasn't gotten plain already, she said, you know, you use your fingers, you use a vibrator, you do whatever. And she said, then you bring yourself to that height of pleasure, to a climax. And she said, as you reach that climax, then you have a phrase that you've already decided on. She said, it really can be anything. It can be, I am the queen. I am supreme. She said, you can say mango if you want to. It's not going to matter. But she said, you decide on a phrase. And then as you bring yourself to that point of climax, you say that during climax. And you look at yourself and you say it out loud. And she said, you do this over and over and over, and you train yourself to respond to those words. She said, in addition, you find some place on your body to touch. She said, it can just be your small finger, your pinky finger on a hand. But when you reach that height of climax, you touch that point on your body, and you say the phrase. And she said, one of the things that this does is, she said, if I was moving into a new situation where I was in an unknown situation, it could have been problematic. She said, as I'm walking into the situation, I say that phrase to myself and I touch myself wherever I've determined that that touch is going to be. And she said, your body will respond. And she didn't say if she could just give herself an orgasm that way. I would find that hard to believe, but she said, your whole body then begins to respond to those memories of what that pleasure felt like. And she said, you know, you can walk in with this bold confidence. And I'm thinking, right, see, there it is. There it is. Usage of the pleasure system to counteract anxiety. She also said that one of the things she would do that's in this same genre, well, she also said, she said, you really just have to know your body. And she said, you have to know what angles work for you and what's pleasurable for you. And so she said, it doesn't really matter what the guy is doing. She said, I could always not only use the former techniques, but also learn how to position my body to where it was going to work for me. And she said, that's why I always had an orgasm with these guys. She said, but the other thing that I would do... is she said, as I was going through these exercises, She said, if I was going to have somebody I was going to try to get attached to, she said, I would take his picture and put it on my mirror as I'm going through these exercises. And as I'm bringing myself to climax, saying the things, touching myself and wherever I decided, she said, I would stare directly at his picture while I was doing all these things. And she said, in that way, when I would meet him for the first time, she said, you know, my whole body is flushing. And she said, I'm amped up and I'm looking at him and my pheromones are going off. And of course, this guy is noticing at a very profound and fundamental level. He's noticing that this woman is sparking. And so, of course, that would attract his attention. And then, of course, her, you know, having satisfying sexual experiences every time they are together, you know, that's going to make him feel like a man's man. And then she can just go from there and develop whatever relationship she wants with him and then get the information she needs from him. So it was all very interesting. But what was most interesting to me about this was this idea of utilizing the female pleasure system, of a woman utilizing the female pleasure system to help her deal with anxiety, to boost her confidence, to cause her to take more command of a situation. And so I'm obviously not proposing, you know, that our good Christian women should just learn to manipulate men and, you know, like some kind of Russian spy or something, but I think there is a fundamental principle in this. And the fundamental principle is that, yes, the reproductive systems in male and female are very different and they are imbalanced. But so are the pleasure systems. And God has specifically designed the female pleasure system to be able to counterbalance against the existing anxiety that the process and the drive of having children required for the species to survive. And it's a gift that God has given women, and it's absolutely up to them whether they want to utilize that or not. But women are in anxious situations and haunted by fears, not because of what God designed, but because perhaps they are not taking advantage of all that God has designed for them. As uncomfortable as that might be to say. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have finished walking around.